You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of September 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, are European Union leaders preparing to restrict freedom of movement when they meet in Slovakia tomorrow? Also ahead...
You think this is easy? In this beautiful room that's 122 degrees? I don't know, folks. You think Hillary would be able to stand up here for an hour and do this? I don't know.
Donald Trump has taken a swipe at Hillary Clinton's pneumonia diagnosis at a rally in Ohio. But does it matter if our politicians aren't as fit as a fiddle? And...
British sovereign territory has been invaded by a foreign power. Mr. Speaker, I'm sure that the whole House will join me in condemning totally this unprovoked aggression by the government of Argentina against British territory.
The UK and Argentina went to war over the Falkland Islands in 1982, but is the frosty relationship between the countries starting to thaw? And we'll also be discussing whether we're now consuming more news online than in more traditional forms of media. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, everyone, to Midori House. My guests today are George Brock, Professor of Journalism at City University London. He also used to work at The Times and The Observer. And we're also joined by Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for the Berliner Zeitung. Welcome to you both. European leaders will gather in Slovakia's capital, Bratislava, tomorrow to discuss what the European Union will look like when the UK finally leaves it. It's thought that freedom of movement will be discussed in an attempt to control potential contagion from Brexit. But today, the former president of the European Council has said that scrapping free movement for EU nationals is not an option. Sebastian Borger, there are two things here. There's the debate in Britain as to what Brexit means, and whether we can have free movement, whether we can have access to the single market without free movement. But then there is this other issue across Europe where there, you know, amongst many people in Europe, the idea of freedom of movement is not as popular perhaps as it once was.
Can I say, first of all, of course, when you look on the agenda, and I think everybody who in charge will tell you that Brexit is not on the agenda. Nobody wants to talk about Brexit. It's all the Brits getting all het up about it. Of course, they're talking about anything but Brexit, because otherwise they would have to invite Theresa May, which they haven't. In fact, of course, they will talk about nothing else. But that's the European way. I think freedom of movement is a non-starter. I simply can't see it happening.
As in changing it is a non-starter.
Yeah.
But there is this issue that, you know, in a number of countries, it's not as popular as it used to be.
The number of countries including?
Well, I think you can say, help me out here, George.
Hungary, the Netherlands, France.
Who wants to live in Hungary in the first place?
Hungarians.
Netherlands. Yeah, well, they don't need any freedom of movement, do they?
No.
I mean, the countries that are interesting here are Britain, not very much. Germany, who gets lots of people, particularly from Spain and Portugal and Italy. France, to some extent, yes. I can't see. I mean, I can only speak for my own country, Germany. I don't see a clamor for getting rid of freedom of movement. Because, you know, let's not forget what it means. It means our people not being able to move elsewhere, to live elsewhere, to work elsewhere, to study elsewhere. And if you tell that in clear terms to the Poles and the Hungarians and whoever else is unwilling to talk about migration and refugees, etc., I think they might be coming up with different solutions.
George, when this EU of 27 minus the UK and Theresa May looks at the big challenges it's got ahead of it. What do you think they will be discussing?
Well, I think Sebastian is absolutely right. In whatever coded form they're doing it, they're not talking about Brexit explicitly, but they are talking about the political strains they've got in the 27. Never mind Britain for one second, and indeed for the whole weekend, as far as they're concerned. But there are anti-immigrant movements. Let's put it that way. Let's leave the phrase freedom of movement aside for one second. There are anti-immigrant movements and parties that are indisputably gaining electorally. They've just gained a little bit in Germany, one of them. And it would be amazing to me if they weren't discussing whether or not they think that's going to peter out, or is it going to make the situation worse? Is it going to affect the major elections in France and Germany this year? Now, almost none of that will appear on the official agenda, but that has to be one of their major concerns. And of course, it's tied up with migration from the Middle East as well.
But sorry, guys, that's exactly the difference. If you talk about freedom of movement within the EU, you talk about something entirely different from migration from Africa and
yeah, I'm leaving that as a separate subject.
That is obviously a main problem and a main source of friction between those countries who have, for whatever reason, refused to take refugees, and those who have, for whatever reason, taken maybe more than they could chew, so to speak. Sorry, inappropriate language. But the internal movement within the EU, that's Britain. That's Britain's
problem. You
really
think it's only a British issue?
Britain,
no one else thinks it's an issue.
For 3 decades, told everybody else, we must expand, we must take in lots of countries, particularly in the East, because we have a moral obligation. In fact, of course, it was all about diluting the project. And as soon as people arrived, people turned around and said, oh, no, we don't want Poles and Lithuanians and Czechs here.
George, so to go back to then what the EU does to try and make itself a little more popular amongst its members, because what's striking is since Brexit, actually the opposite of contagion has happened. You've got a lot of people saying they are far more likely to remain in the European Union. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're happy with what the European Union does.
Yeah, I think they are. Everyone is perfectly right in saying there are no other states that wish to leave the EU or even look remotely likely to do so. That's just a canard, if you see what I mean. But that doesn't stop there being problems and things they've got to discuss. I mean, there was a big speech by Jean-Claude Juncker the other day, the president of the Commission, and his sort of State of the Union address, I think they call it. And
yes, isn't it marvelous?
Isn't it marvelous? And
I was really struck.
It is. Didn't that call a union? Certainly. Well, I was really struck by how little it actually contained. It contained quite a lot of strong language, but what he was essentially, it seemed to me, in the speech was saying, is I can only do the things that you can agree we do. And actually, guys, you're not really agreeing about very much. So I'm a bit, Jean-Claude, I'm a bit stuck. That's how I translate that speech.
But that's the interesting thing. You know, we laugh about the word union, and I think it describes one of the dilemmas of this club, which is about sovereign countries pooling some of their sovereignty. That's what the Brits have never understood. But there are some people, and I mean, George knows that much better because he actually lived and reported on Brussels, who do still believe in the, particularly in the elites, not least in Germany, who still believe that we are moving towards a federal, some sort of federal super state, which I think is pie in the sky. And the problem of the European Union, I think, is that on the one hand, it says, I'm a union, I am important. And on the other hand, it isn't.
And that's the big challenge we've seen, most notably.
And everybody, it's always so easy for Mr. Orbán and whoever else of the populist statespeople around. Sorry, I was going to use another word. To blame everything on Brussels when in fact it's their responsibility. People talk about youth unemployment as if it was Brussels who invented the silly labor laws they have in Spain.
But I agree with you about the gap between rhetoric and reality. I saw a quotation today by an Englishman called Michael Lee, who's a veteran civil servant of the union, and he says, "I don't think you have today in any of the member states a politician who believes that he or she could win an election by saying what we need is more Europe." And I think he's absolutely right.
And that then, Sebastian, is the big challenge for those that believe not necessarily more Europe in a, well, we should be a federal superstate kind of way, but more Europe in that we should be working more effectively in how we pool our sovereignty, and we should be working more effectively with our neighbours. It's still a hard sell, particularly when you look at the two biggest challenges the union's faced over the last five or so years, the flow of refugees and the massive economic crisis that has not just hit Southern Europe, but has also been, Central Europe and Western Europe has played a big part in as well.
We've discussed it for about, 6-7 minutes without mentioning the euro. And of course, the euro is the elephant in the room. Every time I go through Frankfurt and look at the building of the ECB, I think, guys, what in heavens, for heaven's sake, have you built here? The Tower of Babel. And pressed together totally different economies, and we are nowhere near a solution. In fact, I still think that is going to be the next huge problem again.
In what sense do you think that will be the next huge problem?
That the disparities between the economies that work, sort of, Finland, Holland, Germany, and those that don't are growing ever wider.
I just want to briefly, before we move on, touch very briefly on Brexit. I know we can't say anything new, which is part of the thing that makes it quite so fun. But that's the strange thing, George, isn't it? Is that every time there's a European summit or the discussion of Brexit comes up, we end up having the same conversations of politicians in the government saying, well, we'd like to still have access to the single market. And then people in Europe saying, well, actually, you can't have that if you don't accept freedom of movement. Said, well, it depends. There'll be a negotiation. And when Europe goes, well, no, you can't have one without the other. We're going to keep on going around in circles for months and months and months, aren't we?
Yes, but I can give you this consolation, Steve, which is that I think I can see the moment where we will stop going round in circles, and that is after the French election in the spring and after the big German election in the early autumn. At that point...
So in more than a year?
Yep. It's a long time, I know. You've just got to be patient.
Okay, and then we'll have 2 years negotiations once
Can
Article
think
50 has been signed. Brilliant.
Nicer than walking in circles with George and myself.
Okay, there we are. We can walk in circles for another year or so. Let's move on. Yesterday, the UK and Argentina, who of course fought a war in 1982 over control of the Falklands Islands, issued a fairly extraordinary joint statement. It said that the two countries had agreed to improve their often fraught relationship and would cooperate on areas of mutual interest, such as trade and security. It's thought that this could pave the way for a meeting between the British Prime Minister Theresa May and Argentina's President Mauricio Macri at the UN next week. George Brock, they're just a few rocks in the South Atlantic with some sheep on, as they've been described before. Why should anyone in Britain really care who owns the Falklands?
They care because of the recent history in the 1980s. As you mentioned, it was invaded. There are 3,000 people there. The most recent vote that they held there to ask them to which country they wanted to belong, if I remember right, was 2013. And you won't be very surprised to be reminded that they voted decisively in favour of staying with Britain.
Pretty much, almost 100%.
Britain has that obligation, like it or no. And what happens after you have a war over that kind of issue is that there is then a long interval, usually lasting a few decades, and then somebody comes to power in one of the places and says, hey, guys, let's stop doing this. That, I think, is Mr. Macri in Argentina. He seems to be quite a lot more supple or pragmatic or whatever it is about this, and is saying, look, we still claim the islands, of course, we always have, we're there ours, but, you know, should we have a little bit more, you know, relax the rules about shipping or whatever it is that they're going to agree? And you have these tentative rapprochements.
Sebastian, you know, as George points out, it's, you know, Macri has a different style, shall we say, to his predecessor, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, who made the reclamation of the Falklands, or the Malvinas, as she described it, and many in Argentina do, a sort of a real centerpiece of her foreign policy. Is the fact that two leaders who seem to be, or at least have the impression of being, relatively pragmatic, have now come to power, suggest that we're going to have a more sensible way forward?
I think it's a very, very rare piece of very good news, because it represents rational politics. And of course, ironically, looking at what Britain did in June, there is at least a whiff of sharing of sovereignty there. You know, when you look at where the Malvinas stroke the Falklands are, you can't but be struck by the fact how close they are to Argentina, and in any meaningful sense belong to that continent. And of course, at the same time, the inhabitants, as George pointed out, are so very British, maybe in a way which is almost non-existent anymore here on these islands, and are very keen to keep that connection. And so the rational way is what is now being done. I think it's really wonderful that something like that can finally happen. But remember, we had similar moves in the late 70s, early 80s, which, albeit, of course, Argentina was then under military dictatorship, which the British government in the late 70s made moves which were misinterpreted in Buenos Aires to an extent where people talked themselves into believing that Britain was willing to give them up. And I think if we keep clear on both sides what you pointed out, that the Argentinians will always claim it's ours, they're ours, and the Brits will always say they stay with us, then we can move forward.
Okay, we'll take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up next, do our leaders need to be healthy, or how healthy? Stay tuned.
Table for two, sir. Come right this way. You're cordially invited to the launch of our latest book, The Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining. Come the 28th of September, we're laying on a spread of speakers, including River Cafe founder Ruth Rogers and Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé in conversation. Expect tasty treats from talented London chef Tom Aldroyd, drinks aplenty, and a hospitable evening of drinking and dining at Monocle's Marylebone HQ in London. Plus a copy of our freshly prepared book, of course. Hungry for more? We thought you might be. Tickets are available from monocle.com/events.
And you're back with me, Steve Bloomfield, on Midori House here on Monocle 24. Does the health of our politicians matter? Donald Trump certainly thinks so. He mocked Hillary Clinton at a rally in Ohio last night after she revealed she'd been diagnosed with pneumonia. But the Libertarian candidate for the presidency, Gary Johnson, was a little more conciliatory. He says that questions about the health of our politicians are illegitimate. Still with me are Sebastian Borger and George Brock. George Brock, questions about health are legitimate, aren't they? The issue is whether Hillary Clinton here has necessarily done anything that Donald Trump hasn't done either.
I can't understand what Gary Johnson is talking about. Of course they're legitimate. I mean, it's one of the most stressful jobs on the planet, if not the most. And it follows naturally from that that there are some legitimate questions about health. There are obviously pieces of private information that have not, you know, are not in any way in the public interest. But clearly, somebody's ability to stand up to the job is part of it. And it's, you know, it's not just Trump voters who've asked themselves whether a candidate touching 70 is really the right person at that age for that job. But on the other hand, given the strain that they now have to undergo merely to get the job, let alone actually perform it, is it any surprise that once or twice people fall ill when it happens? It doesn't surprise me in the least. And as for Trump's behavior, we should stop being surprised that he just does something newly repulsive, because every time I think the American campaign can't get worse, it does.
Indeed. George Brock, if Donald Trump becomes president, he'll be the oldest man to become president. If Hillary Clinton, she'd be the second oldest. So these are legitimate questions in a sense, aren't they? And I guess the bigger issue here is not, you know, what Hillary said at the time or what she released a few hours later. It's the fact that we still don't have proper health records for Donald Trump.
You wanted me. I don't understand. If you know, candidates are scrutinized, as they quite rightly are, then health records ought to be released from all camps, I would have thought. Hillary Clinton's campaign, of course, made several mistakes, I think, in the communication of the way she fell ill and was then diagnosed. I mean, there are several different sorts of pneumonia, as I have found out in my family recently, and apparently there are more strains around. Anyway, you know, it can all be explained, and it can be, and it's not terribly surprising that it happens. I think the problem was that they tried to cover it up. Yes, of course, I'd want to see Trump's health bulletins, and if they aren't public yet, then the American press has something to answer for, I would have thought.
George, of course, leaders previously didn't have to release quite so much information about their health, or that it was a lot easier to conceal things. Winston Churchill, for example, had his fair share of illnesses. I just want to read a note from a doctor given to Winston Churchill after he had a car accident in 1932. Says, the convalescence of the Honourable Winston Churchill necessitates the use of alcoholic spirits, especially at mealtimes. The quantity is naturally indefinite, but the minimum requirements would be 250 cubic centimetres.
That's my kind of doctor.
I can't quite imagine someone like Churchill running for office now and getting away with certain types of things he might have got away with 70-odd years ago.
No, but then the strain of the job was much worse. But let's also just look at the overarching thing here. In general, I'm in favour of openness and disclosure up to a certain point about medical information. That's all fine. The problem, however, is that a large chunk of the American electorate, when this becomes weaponized in a political campaign, there is now a large chunk of the American electorate which is not believing anything that they are told, not just by one candidate or the other, but quite largely by the mainstream media. They regard everything they're getting from the mainstream media, everything they're getting from both politicians of both political parties and everybody who they regard as the establishment as lies. So you won't necessarily settle these questions with factual information, however authentic and accurate it is.
Let's move then from there onto our final item, because I think there's something of a link. There's a new report which suggests that this year has witnessed the tipping point in media consumption. Apparently we are becoming, and this is the quote, superhuman information absorbers, with half of our waking hours now spent consuming media or online information. And I guess, George Brock, the phrase online information is key here, because although we might be For example, listening to a podcast like this online, or reading an established newspaper with some fantastic journalists online, or also reading things that we found on Facebook or on social media, where the source may not be as illustrious or as fact-heavy as others are.
Well, I mean, clearly, when you have digital information, you have a gigantic amount of trash and occasionally some diamonds in the trash can. Don't forget that the category digital content here is extremely broad, and a certain amount of what's happened is what I think statisticians call substitution. In other words, you're looking up on your Kindle or your computer something that you would have looked up on a book. You're doing the same thing. Mm. You're discovering the information.
You're reading the same newspaper you always read, but you're reading it on your tablet.
But you are consuming it in a digital fashion. So it is not necessary that, you know, that those hours measure a whole novelty in people being bent over their phones, although most of the people you see in the street appear to be doing just that. I think that there will be a swing back against this. Most new forms of communication, everybody gets wildly enthusiastic about them. People predict that they're going to solve world peace and a whole lot of other problems, and then they don't. And then there's a kind of swing backwards to slightly more sensible, slightly more rational use. I'm still expecting that to happen because we're at a very, very early phase of the use of these, all the devices we use, and a lot of them are going to develop. And I have a question. I don't know which generation we're at. Are we at Generation Z now?
X to millennials, I think, was the next generation.
Oh, I thought maybe we were even getting past Generation Z.
Although, was Generation Y? I don't know which one that was.
I have a question about Generation Z, which is, when we're past Generation Z, what happens? Do we go to Generation A? Anyway, maybe Generation Z
will come up with a new name.
Generation Z may be just much more sensible about this. They may actually start to calm down. You know, people, when I was little, people used to worry about people watching too much TV. Now,
well, look,
that
we're
watch much less
okay,
TV.
Okay, well, then that's the point I want to raise. Sebastian, is this not then the thing that is always moaned about? It's whatever the new media is. It's like, you know, you can look back to, you know, early 1900s and people moaning that no one speaks to each other on the trains anymore because they've got these newfangled newspapers in front of them.
yes and no. I mean, I grew up, of course, in Germany with Chancellor Helmut Schmidt, who famously at one stage asked people to give up television for a day a week. No, of course they didn't. But you know, as the leader of a country, to say something like that, I thought required some guts. And of course, what he meant was not get away from the news and let me get on with governing. What he meant was do something else. You know, go for a walk, go to a museum, one of those politicians who had a hinterland, and look at some art and stuff like that. And I have to say that what George just alluded to, the way people, I was just back in my hometown of Munich, the way people walk around with their eyes glued to the screen, without actually looking at
and this is in Germany, where you guys still read physical newspapers.
Splendid architecture and the people around them, I find very depressing.
George, there have been a couple of government initiatives around the world to try and shift people back to print, whether that's newspapers or books. A few years ago, Nicolas Sarkozy gave every French person who was 18, I think, a year's free subscription to a newspaper. Mm-hmm. We've just had the Italian government saying they were going to give 500 euros to 18-year-olds to spend on books. Do these things actually help? Is there a point to them?
No, my heart sinks every time I hear about government initiatives of this kind. Actually, books, printed books, are basically looking fine.
Back.
They're looking
back.
Really good.
They're coming back.
They're
yes,
back.
Absolutely.
Book sales are not in trouble, therefore the governments can just leave that alone. They're managing fine without, thank you. Attempts to defend newspapers by subsidy, market rigging, artificial means, they will simply fail. They're a complete waste of money. Don't vote for governments which do them.
And generally on this issue, because you've written about this a lot, you've even written a book called Out of Print, are you actually quite hopeful about a lot of the, to use the horrible phrase, digital content we're consuming?
Yes. The digital era has produced a vast amount of new information. Some of it is ghastly, some of it is nobody wants, some of it is valueless. But the fact is that it has broken a lot of molds, it has created it is an enormous engine of opportunity, and when we look back on it in 50 years' time, we will think, hey, that wasn't bad.
There we are. Hopefully you'll look back on this show and think, hey, that wasn't bad. George Brock, Sebastian Borger, thank you both very much indeed. That's it for Midori House. It was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Luke Saunders. The studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. Music next, then it's The Urbanist. Tom Edwards, your host today. Midori House, back same time tomorrow. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.